Well, brethren, good morning to those of you across the Atlantic Ocean, and good afternoon to those few of you over here in the United Kingdom. Some weeks ago, you'll recollect, we began a Bible study or a Bible reading of the book of Exodus. And we've had a slight break for a couple of weeks now with the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, now, of course, behind us. But it's time to sort of pick up the story and continue on. And what we're hoping to achieve ultimately is to basically read through the entire book of Exodus. I think I said at the very outset some time ago that we do want to make sure we read God's Word, the Bible. Perhaps in past years we've read the entire Bible or entire books of it. But it's amazing how sometimes you just find it difficult to get the time to read God's Word. So what we've done is we've recently been through the entire book of Genesis, and we're now making good progress through the hopefully the entire book of Exodus. And today we'll pick up the story in Exodus chapter 18. So we've been through Moses' calling, been through the 10 plagues, been through that very first Passover, the escape of Israel through the Red Sea, into the wilderness, the giving of the manna, and so on. And now we're heading very much towards the Feast of Pentecost. But picking up the story now, as I say, in chapter 18, book of Exodus, and verse 1. And Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, that the Eternal had brought Israel out of Egypt. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back, with her two sons, of whom the name of the one was Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a foreign land, and the name of the other was Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father was my help, and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness, where he was encamped at the mountain of God. Now, according to verse 5, Jethro and Zipporah and the two lads arrived when Moses was actually at Mount Sinai. And, of course, at this stage, chapter 18, they hadn't actually reached Mount Sinai, as far as we're aware. I think we'll see in Exodus 19 their arrival actually at Mount Sinai. And that's the reason some commentators say that probably chapter 18 is an inset chapter. It doesn't follow the exact chronology from chapter 17 to 18 to 19. Chapter 18 that Luke's has been inserted here for another purpose. If you have a copy of the Companion Bible produced by Mr. Bullinger, you'll find that he puts the entirety of chapter 18 in brackets. Carrying on, verse 6. Now he had said to Moses, I, your father-in-law, Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her. So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, bowed down, and kissed him. And they asked each other about their well-being, and they went into the tent. And so I guess it's a fairly joyful reunion. Having been separated for a number of months and so on, at last you get back to see your wife and your young boys and your father-in-law. And it seems clear that Moses and his father-in-law got on fairly well together. In verse 8, Moses told his father-in-law all that the Eternal had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them on the way, and how the Eternal had delivered them. And of course, for us today, we get our news almost immediately. If you switch on the radio, you can get up-to-the-minute details of what's taking place in Japan or in Iraq or wherever. You switch on your internet, and you can look at Yahoo or Google and catch the news happening immediately But in these days, of course, that would not be the case. And Jethro may have wondered, I wonder what took place. I wonder what Moses did. I wonder what the eternal Jehovah God did. I wonder how hard it was. I wonder what's taken place these last few weeks. How is my son-in-law? And so, he'd spend a good bit of time, I'm sure, sitting in the tent, relaxing and talking over all the details, the plagues, the hail, the fire, the lice, you know, the death of the firstborn. I mean, dramatic, incredible developments. And no doubt Jethro's ears were flapping with interest as he heard this fantastic story, as he heard that basically the most powerful empire, cultured, militarily strong, had been essentially destroyed. How the armies of Pharaoh, the cavalry, the pride of the infantry and so on, had died, drowned in the Red Sea. This was all amazing news to Jethro. Verse 9. Then Jethro rejoiced for all the good which the Eternal had done for Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, Blessed be the Eternal, who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and who has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Eternal, Jehovah, is greater than all the gods, for in the very thing in which they behaved proudly, he was above them. And I'm not too sure about Jethro's theology, exactly what gods or goddesses he had in his background, but he was certainly pretty impressed here by the God of Israel. This God appeared to be an awful lot more powerful than the gods he was used to. Then Jethro, verse 12, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. And notice here, by the way, that there were already leading men in Israel. They are the elders. They'd be the heads of the families, the heads of the tribes, men who'd been, I guess as you would say today, around the block a few times, individuals who were recognized for their seniority, the wisdom that comes with age and experience, and so on. And these leading elders, you know, came for this, I guess it was probably quite a feast, quite a banquet. Verse 13. And so it was on the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, because they had all sorts of questions, disputes, arguments. Let's not forget what the Israelites were like. I think we've seen already in the story so far that they could be quite a cantankerous bunch of people who were always challenging God and certainly challenging each other. If you think of the fact that today the Jewish people and the American people and the British people are the descendants of ancient Israel, and just think how many lawyers there are in our societies. I think in particular the United States can claim the fame or the infamy of having more lawyers per head of population than anywhere else on the earth, multiplied several times over. And that's because as a people we just love to argue in the courts. We love to sue other people to claim for all manner of things. I mean, nowadays, you know, people that have overindulged in fast foods are quite happy to try to sue the likes of Burger King and McDonald's for making me fat. The fact that nobody forced a quadruple McChicken sandwich down our throats goes ignored. So I'm no doubt that at this time there were plenty of arguments between the peoples of Israel. And so, verse 13, they came to Moses. After all, he's your head man. He's the head honcho. He should have all the answers. And the people stood before Moses from morning until evening. Now, one can only imagine the attitude of these people. We might think that they were very patient and tolerant and humble and waiting there quietly for their turn to ask Moses a question. Knowing Israelites, I suspect there was a great deal of pushing, shoving, backbiting, finger-pointing, irritation, complaining, and murmuring. So when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you sit alone, and all the people stand before you from morning until evening?" I mean, they're there for 12 hours, Moses, trying to get your attention. I mean, this is ridiculous. And Moses said to his father-in-law, "Well, because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a difficulty or a dispute, they come to me, and I judge between one and another, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws." So that was Moses' role, in a sense. He was acting as an arbiter and saying, "Well, I've heard your story, Mr. Smith, and I've heard your tale, Mr. Jones, and looking at it, I believe that God's opinion would be as follows." And then he would give a judgment based upon his knowledge of God's laws and God's mind. And hopefully the people would probably then accept Moses' view. Hopefully, but I'm not sure they always would. But notice also in this verse that Moses is making known to them the statutes and the laws. And that's one of the main purposes of any man of God, is to explain to people, to expound to people God's laws, how they work, why it's for our benefit that we actually keep them. Human nature hasn't changed since the days of ancient Israel. We know from Romans that the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. It's just impossible. And that was exactly the case way back in the days of ancient Israel, and it's the case even today in modern Israel. It's just natural for us to oppose and be antagonistic towards God's laws. That's why we all need to be reminded frequently that God's laws aren't hostile to us. They actually tell us how to live better, how to be more successful in our domestic arrangements, financially, at work, as a society. And if the world ever realized that God's laws are for our good, for our benefit, and actually then did them, it would totally transform the world. And of course, the world tomorrow will be transformed, largely because God's laws will then be understood by the whole world. Continuing, verse 17. So Moses' father-in-law said to him, "The thing that you do is not good." "I'm sorry, Moses," he says, "I've got to really criticize what you're doing here. Your intention, no doubt, is very good. But both you and these people who are with you will surely wear yourselves out, for this thing is too much for you. You are not able to perform it by yourself." Which I think was probably extremely fair comment. One man with hundreds or maybe thousands of, at times, carnal, bad-tempered individuals. And let's face it, these were carnal individuals when they stood before Moses. I can't imagine they were all scrupulously honest with their tale. One imagines that they were crafty and devious and twisted the story to suit themselves. So Moses had to really ask perhaps some rather hard questions to try and find out what exactly is true here. Who's exaggerating what information, trying to put one over on me so that I make the wrong judgment? So it was jolly hard work. And, you know, Jethro could see that. Verse 19, "Listen now to my voice. I will give you counsel, and God will be with you. Stand before God for the people, so that you may bring the difficulties to God. And you shall teach them the statutes and the laws, and show them the way in which they must walk, and the work they must do." And of course, that's what you and I today should be doing. Learning God's statutes and laws, and finding out the way in which we should walk, and the work that you and I should do. Nothing has really changed there. Verse 21, "Moreover," says Jethro, "you shall select from all the people able men," you know, men who are competent, "such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And let them judge the people at all times. And so we can see here that Jethro was really recommending a bit of delegation to Moses. Look, Moses, one man can't look after the disputes of, 5 million people. It's a bit too much. Moses, no matter how competent you are, this is really a task too great for you. What you need is other individuals who can share the load. But these individuals have got to be of a certain type, certain character traits. They must be able men, competent. They understand. They have ability. They must be men who fear God. And if you think about it, if one was choosing today, elders, shall we say, individuals to serve in any capacity, whether it would be in the church or elsewhere, this is what really you would still want, even today. Men that fear God, men of truth, men who hate covetousness, are not in it for the money. You can't bribe them by sort of dangling 500 bucks under their nose and saying, if you could just find in my favor this 500 crisp dollar bill, if there is such a thing, is yours. You don't want men who do things for the wrong reason, for money, or perhaps coveting promotion. You don't want that. And these individuals who are to be men of a very good standard, of a high moral value, were to be placed over thousands and hundreds and fifties and so on. And they were to judge the people at all times. Verse 22, then it will be that every great matter, the really difficult ones, they shall bring to you. But every small matter, they themselves shall judge. So it will be easier for you, for they will bear the burden with you. If you do this thing, and God so commands you, check it out with God first, Moses, then you will be able to endure, and all this people will also go to their place in peace. I think the implication was there was far from being peaceful at the moment. They were probably jostling and shoving. If you'd been in a queue, as we'd say in Britain, but in a line in America, all day long, and your bunions were playing up, you were tired, your stomach was rumbling, the young kids were sort of pulling and pushing at you to sort of, because they were tired and getting very restless, you'd be rather bad-tempered. And I think it's knowing human nature, these people probably were bad-tempered. And so Jethro says, look, let's share out the load, Moses, get dozens and dozens of very capable men, and they can sort out the less troublesome issues themselves. And you can carry the really big, difficult questions before God. And that looked like some good advice. Verse 24. So Moses heeded the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers or governors or chiefs or captains of thousands, captains of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. So they judged the people at all times. The hard cases they brought to Moses, but they judged every small case themselves. And then Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went his way to his own land. Now, those of you who have been around the churches of God for any number of decades may remember times in the past when there were individuals who were rulers of tens and rulers of fifties and so on that very much let it go to their heads. And it's fair to say, I think, that this particular chapter and the example that Jethro gave to Moses has been somewhat abused. I know I've certainly been in situations where so-called rulers have laid down the law very strictly and have been very much, choose my words carefully, arrogant and pompous in commanding what one should or should not do. I recollect very clearly one ruler of whatever, he was actually the ruler of the car park at the building where our services were held many years ago, and he ruled with a rod of iron over the car park. When you drove up, he could tell you, A, whether you could actually stay in the car park at all, there were limited spaces, and sometimes he would decide that, well, you better drive off and find another car park. We're not letting you in here today. Alternatively, it would be park your car over there. And heaven help you if you parked your car somewhere else than where he pointed out, because he was the ruler over the car park. And the example in Exodus 18 was often used by individuals to say, look, I'm a ruler over 50. If you want to go against my direct commands to you, you better raise it up with a ruler over 100. And you have to go up the hierarchical ladder to a higher level to get that decision sort of countermanded. I remember another occasion when this particular concept was being applied, when a sermonette giver had decided to encourage the congregation to come to that evening's social event after church. That was going to be coffee, tea, biscuits, some board games, I think some music, fellowship basically, and quite a fine idea. But this sermonette giver, on the basis that he was a ruler over whatever, decided that he was commanding people that they must come to the social. And if they rejected his direct command to come to the social, they were rejecting Jesus Christ, because he stood in place of Jesus Christ when he said, brethren, if you're not at the social tonight, you are sinning. You're going contrary to the direct will of God, because I'm a ruler over, 100 people in this context at this time, and these are my commands to you. And if the minister says otherwise, fine, but otherwise, that's my orders. And really, it got very, very silly. And many people took this question of being a ruler over 10 or 50 to a ridiculous extreme. What they were actually doing, of course, in Exodus 18 was men who were making judgments about, simple, relatively straightforward disputes between members of the society. Interesting also that it wasn't that the leaders of the 50s and 10s and 100s were actually chosen exactly by Moses. Moses appointed them, but they were actually chosen by the people. We turn to Deuteronomy chapter 1. So keep your place in Exodus 18:19. But turn to Deuteronomy chapter 1, starting at verse 9. And Moses is again teaching Israel towards the end of his life. Verse 9, and I spoke to you at that time, saying, I alone am not able to bear you. The Eternal your God has multiplied you, and here you are today as the stars of heaven in multitude. May the Eternal God of your fathers make you 1,000 times more numerous than you are, and bless you as he has promised you. How can I alone bear your problems and your burdens and your complaints? And I'm sure that Moses' ears were probably red from all the murmuring and complaining he was hearing day by day. Verse 13, choose wise. Now this is addressed to the people. You choose wise, understanding, and knowledgeable men from among your tribes, and I will make them heads or captains or rulers or governors over you. And you answered me and said, the thing which you have told us to do is good. That's a great idea, Moses. And so I took the heads of your tribes, wise and knowledgeable men, the ones that the congregation had chosen, and made them heads over you, leaders of thousands, leaders of hundreds, of fifties, leaders of tens, and officers for your tribes. And I imagine that since the people had chosen these individuals, that they had a certain amount of credibility or belief in them. Then I commanded your judges at that time, saying, hear the cases between your brethren, and judge righteously between a man and his brother or the stranger who is with him. You shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall hear the small as well as the great. You shall not be afraid in any man's presence, for the judgment is God's. The case that is too hard for you, bring it to me, and I will hear it. And I commanded you at that time all the things which you should do. So that was how the judicial system was set up, a system of wise, knowledgeable, able men who would not show partiality, who were not covetous, who were men of truth, and they were established among the people, among that society, to help resolve difficulties. Moving on now to chapter 19. In the third month, after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. Now, what does it mean by the same day? The answer is that it was on the same day of the week as they had left Egypt, which would be, in this case, a Thursday. I can't go into the proof of that for now. If you're interested, there's some old articles on that topic. But let's just carry on with the story. So we're taking this to be Thursday when they arrived at Sinai. For they had departed from Rephidim, had come to the desert of Sinai, and camped in the wilderness. So Israel camped there before the mountain, also known as Mount Horeb, the mountain of God. Verse 3. And Moses went up to God, and the Eternal called him from the mountain, saying, Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. And I heard a tape many years ago about eagles, and how the parent eagles, the mummy and daddy eagles, how they look after the young eagles and teach them to fly. And it seems, from what I can recollect, and you may know the story better than I do, that the parent eagle sort of coaxes the young eagle onto his back, flies off several thousand feet up in the air, and then just sort of casually rolls over on his back, and little young eaglet drops off and starts falling free through the air, a bit like without a parachute. And of course, little eagle probably, I imagine, panics somewhat. Here I am, 5,000 feet above the desert floor, falling through the air, and little eaglet starts flapping his or her wings and does a sort of a beginner's job of trying to fly, and the big eagle just circles around and just watches progress. And then, as the little eaglet is perhaps running out of puff, the big eagle swoops in beneath, catches the baby eagle on its wings, circles again higher and higher, and then does the same again. Rolls over, and off drops little eagle, flapping away madly once more. And the big eagle just circles round, comes underneath, catches it on his wings, goes back up and does it again and again. And after a few episodes, little eagle is flying quite happily. So this, in a sense, this verse indicates that, you know, God was always circling around, watching Israel, offering security, preserving Israel, helping out, and doing what a big eagle does, making sure that its offspring is protected and healthy and kept safe and sound. Verse 5. Now therefore, if, and it's probably worthwhile just noticing the word if, it's a small word with big implications, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you will be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine, and if you do that, you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now, these are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel. And these two verses are really very important in many ways for us, because these are the verses that it's the invitation, in a sense, to marriage. Here is Jehovah God, the Logos, the one who became Jesus Christ latterly, and he's inviting the nation of Israel to marry him, entering into a covenant. And this is what we know as the Old Covenant, where the nation of Israel was offered fantastic blessings to be a special treasure to God, to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. I mean, really, these people had been only some 7 weeks earlier a slave people in Egypt, and had been for many years, for decades and decades. And here the God of creation is saying, look, I want to enter into an agreement with you, a covenant. I want you to agree to my covenant, and if you do, if you will obey me and heed my voice, I'm going to separate you as a nation. You're going to become a holy people. You become a kingdom of priests, of educators, my representatives, and I will bless you abundantly if you will obey me. And it's a fantastic opportunity. It's the old covenant. There's tremendous blessings there. And of course, for us today, we have a very similar invitation, what we might call the new covenant. But it's very similar to be made a nation, to be separated, you know, for God's benefits. If we turn to 1 Peter chapter 2, so keep your finger there again. 1 Peter chapter 2. And we pick up the story just briefly in verse 9. So first letter of Peter, chapter 2, and verse 9, Peter's writing to the called out ones, the people of God. So hopefully that would include you and me. And he says, verse 9, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. So Peter says there that these are the exact same descriptions we read about in Exodus 19. A holy nation, a kingdom of priests, a chosen, selected generation, God's special people, his special treasure. So what was offered in the Old Covenant to ancient Israel, that you and I are in that same process here in the New Covenant. Going back to Exodus 19. Carrying on the story in verse 7. So Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before them all these words which the Eternal commanded him. Then all the people answered together and said, Amen, brother. All the Eternal has spoken, we will do. Because they thought, hang on a moment. A special nation? Special to this Jehovah God? A kingdom of priests? Wow. This sounds like an offer we cannot refuse. So they said, Amen. I do. A bit like in a marriage ceremony. Do you, prospective wife, confirm and agree in covenant that you will honor this gentleman, that you will obey him in all things and heed his voice, because then he'll sort of bless you? Oh, I do. And so that's pretty much the wedding ceremony. And the Eternal said to Moses, verse 9, Behold, I come to you in the thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with you and believe you forever. So God was ensuring that people realize just how, in a sense, important to God Moses was. So Moses told the words of the people to the Eternal. Then the Eternal said to Moses, Go to the people and sanctify them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their clothes, and let them be ready for the third day. From the third day, the Eternal will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. And this third day would be Pentecost. If you heard the last tape message, I think it was, we were counting our way through the seven Sabbaths. You'll recollect that in the days of unleavened bread, we find the wave sheaf offering Sunday, and from that we count seven Sabbath days until the day after the seventh Sabbath, which brings us to Pentecost, the 50th day. And the previous tape, I think we went through Sabbaths 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. This brings us to Sabbath number 7, and then the day after, the third day here, being Pentecost, as far as we can tell. Verse 12. You shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, Take heed to yourselves, that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. Which is, you know, quite a strong warning. And I think we all should understand that, you know, God is very holy, and we should be very careful ourselves not to treat with any casual nature or disrespect things that are holy to God, wherever they might be. Not a hand shall touch him. So anybody who would touch the mountain should not be then grabbed and removed. But he shall surely be stoned from a distance, I guess, or shot with an arrow from a distance. Whether man or beast, he shall not live. When the trumpet sounds long, they shall come near the mountain, but obviously not to actually touch it. Verse 14. Then Moses went down from the mountain to the people and sanctified the people, and they washed their clothes. And he said to the people, be ready for the third day. Do not come near your wives. They had to remain, if you like, ceremonially pure. Then it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunderings and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain. And the sound of the trumpet was very loud, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. We've got to use our imaginations here a little bit, but here's a gigantic mountain stretching up many thousands of feet into the air. The top of the mountain you cannot see because there's a very dark black cloud hanging over it. There is thundering and lightning. I'm sure it would be quite spectacular. I don't think it's one or two flashes of lightning per hour. I suspect this is like endless lightning and thundering and flashing and so on. And the sound of a trumpet blowing continually. And it was so intimidating and so scary that these people, just their knees were knocking out in the camp. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. And one imagines they were all pretty nervous, because again, I think we know from other passages that these people never did trust God. And we know a few weeks later they refused point blank to go into the promised land, even though they were at the borders, because they were always, I think, in their hearts, convinced God was out to kill them. And so here they'd be thinking about, this does not look good. This whole mountain is shaking, and the earth's moving, and there's lightning and thunder, and a volcano's about to erupt. I think we're going to be destroyed now. This is it. This is the end of us. Verse 18. Now Mount Sinai was completely in smoke, because the Eternal descended upon it in fire. So it gets even more frightening. You know, some flames ablaze and burning and shining and smoke pouring everywhere. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. So just, you know, shaking up and down. And when the blast of the trumpet sounded long and became louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him by voice. So Moses, I guess himself, was probably quite impressed by this, but the people were, I think, just terrified. Then the Eternal came down upon Mount Sinai on the top of the mountain, and the Eternal called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And you've got to say that, you know, Moses must have been a remarkable man. You know, that God would actually deal with Moses in that sense, you know, virtually face to face. And, you know, Moses learned, I'm sure, many lessons in his life, but by this stage he'd become, you know, very, very useful to God, and God, I'm sure, actually quite delighted in Moses' company. And will again when Moses is resurrected. And the Eternal said to Moses, go down and warn the people, lest they break through to gaze at the Eternal, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near the Eternal sanctify themselves, lest the Eternal break out against them. And Moses said to the Eternal, well, but the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you warned us already, saying, set bounds around the mountain and consecrate it, sanctify it. The Eternal said to him, away, get down and then come up, you and Aaron with you. But do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Eternal, lest he break out against them. So Moses went down to the people and spoke to them. So just double checking, I guess God must have suspected that some of the people, terrified or not, would have been so anxious to catch a view of this powerful supernatural being that they perhaps would still have broken through and tried to see what's behind the smoke and the clouds. And so just making doubly certain, nobody comes near Moses apart from you and some of the priests. Then moving down to chapter 20. I think this is a chapter that we know fairly well. It contains the the Ten Commandments. And just before I sort of get into the sort of chapter 20, there are many people that do think the Old Covenant, which we just read about, and this is part of the Old Covenant ceremony taking place at this moment. God's about to begin the perhaps the most important part of it with the eternal spiritual moral law. But there are many, many people, most Protestants, I suspect, probably Catholics, that they always think the Old Covenant is just the sacrifices and all the washings and things that had to be done. And they can't, in their own mind, ever seem to separate the fact that the Old Covenant, believe it or not, didn't actually contain, initially, any sacrifices. Over the next sort of half hour or so, as we continue, and probably on the next time we go through Exodus chapters 21, 2, 3, 4, we'll get up to the sealing of the covenant, and we won't find sacrifices. We won't find a sacrificial system. And yet, you can guarantee, if you ever were to talk about the Old Covenant with people, they'd always think of it in terms of the sacrifices, the offerings, the washings, which, of course, we all know were done away. And so they tend to think, well, if they were done away, the Old Covenant as a whole was done away. Well, it's not quite accurate. If we keep our finger or a card there and turn to Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 21, we can just double check what was in the Old Covenant to start with and what was not. Jeremiah chapter 7 and verses 21 to 23. And here we read, "Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, the God of Israel, add you burnt offerings to your sacrifices and eat meat, for I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt, concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices." You know, when God brought Israel out, when he entered into the Old Covenant, he did not discuss or raise or put burnt offerings or sacrifices into the arrangement. But, verse 23, "This is what I commanded them, saying, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people, and walk in all the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well with you." That's what God said to them. That's what we're about to start reading in Exodus 20 when we turn back there. You know, God said, obey my voice. Heed my voice. You know, have a right heart. Live my way. But there's nothing we'll find in the next few chapters about sacrifices or offerings or a sacrificial system. Like it says here in verse 22, God didn't raise that when they came out of Egypt. To be fair, it wasn't too long before it had to be added, because the people were people, they were carnal, they broke God's laws within hours, as we'll see later, and hence God did actually add the sacrificial system some months later. It was, in fact, almost 1 year later that it came into being. If we turn to Galatians chapter 3, just continuing the same theme for a moment, Galatians chapter 3, and verse 19. Galatians chapter 3, reading verse 19, and it's cutting into the context, which I don't like doing, but the book of Galatians would take an entire three Bible studies itself, I guess, to go through, which I might do one of these days. It's one of my favorite New Testament books. It's it was the first Bible study book that we ever went through when I came into God's church many years ago. One minister went through Galatians chapters 1, 2, and 3, and he was a very good minister, very solid, very sound, very dedicated and sincere, and made a big impact on me. And I always remember his explanations of Galatians 1, 2, and 3. But then he was replaced by another minister, and two of the ministers went through Galatians 4, 5, and 6 and virtually reversed everything that was said by the first minister. And then these guys, well, I don't think their hearts were in it, put it that way. But anyway, Galatians 3:19. "What purpose then does the law serve? Well, here we have to know that the law being referred to is the law of rituals, the law of sacrifices. It was added because of transgressions, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made. And it was appointed through angels by the hand of a mediator. The law of rituals, the law of sacrifices, was added because the people broke the spiritual law. It was added because of transgressions. So we're talking here of a law that was added later on because of their inability to keep the law. And if we turn finally to Hebrews chapter 9, Hebrews chapter 9, verse 6, to start with. Hebrews 9, verse 6. Now when these things had been thus prepared, the priests always went into the first part of the tabernacle performing the services. So they would do all the cleaning and the sacrificing and so on. Dropping down to verse 9. It was symbolic for the present time in which both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make him who performed the service perfect in regard to the conscience. You know, if you're a person that's lustful or bad-tempered or born idle or gossips a lot, then, you know, bringing a lamb or a pigeon to be sacrificed doesn't make your mind any better. It doesn't improve your conscience. Verse 10, concerned only with foods and drinks, various washings, and fleshly ordinances imposed until the time of Reformation. This was temporary. The sacrifices are there for a limited time only. Chapter 10 of Hebrews, we'll read the first four verses. For the law, having a shadow of good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never, with these same sacrifices, which they offer continually year by year, make those who approach perfect. For then would they not have ceased to be offered. You know, if sacrifices made you a good person, well, after a while, you wouldn't need any more. You'd be a good person. For the worshippers, once purged, would have had no more consciousness of sins. But in those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins every year. For it is not possible that the blood of bulls and goats could take away sins. And, of course, that's why it was temporary. Going back to Exodus chapter 20. So we should remember that the Old Covenant, which we're now in the middle of reading about, did not at first contain these sacrifices, these fleshly ordinances, these washings of animals' insides and so on. They were added approximately 1 year later. I've got a reference in my margin, no idea where it came from. It says it was 11 months and 15 days later, but say a year later. So at this time, sacrifices are not part of the Old Covenant. Simple as that. Verse 1 of chapter 20. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Eternal, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. Key commandment, really. No other gods before the true God. And how many in the world today keep that commandment? Verse 4, which is commandment number 2. You shall not make for yourself any carved image or any likeness, and that could be painted as a painting or a statuette or whatever, of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Eternal, your God, am a jealous God, visiting or punishing the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. So commandment 2 says, don't make any representation, whether it's a carving, a statuette, a painting, to bow down to worship it. Now, if you're a Catholic, you probably won't often see that particular commandment. I was raised as a Catholic, and in Catholic school, you'd be shown a fairly short version of the Ten Commandments. Now, there were Ten Commandments, but the order is a wee bit different from what we see in the King James Version and New King James Version. And what you find is that this particular commandment about the representations, the statues and the paintings, doesn't normally appear. It's sort of all lumped in with the first commandment. So don't have any other false god of any sort, and brackets, don't make any idols, brackets. But that part, generally speaking, isn't published very often. If you look hard, you'll find it. But by and large, it's just one commandment, no other gods. And I think the reason is fairly obvious. If you walk into any Catholic church or cathedral, you'll find representations of everything under the sun there, and people bowing down in front of them. I've bowed down in front of statues and statuettes of the Blessed Virgin Mary many times. I've bowed down in front of statues of St. Margaret. I might mention her later. She's the one of the patrons of in Scotland. And the school I went to was called St. Margaret's Roman Catholic School. So I've knelt in front of St. Margaret, or at least a statuette of her. I've knelt in front of various paintings of Jesus going through his so-called passion, what's called the Stations of the Cross, 12 episodes in Jesus' last few hours, and you kneel in front of each picture, and you raise your eyes in adoration, and you pray a prayer towards the picture. Now, I've done that, and so have, I guess, the odd half billion Catholics, and it's actually forbidden. But you won't see that particular commandment very often. It's generally sort of tucked away out of sight. And then, of course, all the commandments are numbered differently thereafter. Because the next commandment, verse 7 says, we'd say the third commandment, you shall not take the name of the Eternal your God in vain, for the Eternal will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. But to the Catholics, that's probably commandment number 2. Because, okay, one's disappeared, more or less. And we should be careful, by the way, not to take God's name in vain. That would certainly include, you know, swear words when you hit your thumb with a hammer and things of that nature. But also even just using God's name unnecessarily and casually and just throwing it around, you know, and so on is not a good idea either. We should be fairly respectful of our God. Verse 8, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Eternal your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your manservant, nor your maidservant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Eternal made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Eternal blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. That's, as Mr. Armstrong said, the longest commandment. And it's tucked away nicely in the middle, protected. And yet, it's the one commandment of them all that people really, in the world and in religion, well, let's face it, they hate this commandment. The Sabbath day, Jewish. Well, I'm sorry, this is God speaking. It's his Sabbath day. It's holy to him. He set it apart. Now, we know all that. But the world and religion will try every manner of means they can to try to wriggle around the Sabbath commandment. At least in Europe, I can't say about the USA, but certainly in Europe, there are a number of calendars you can buy, a number of diaries that you might purchase to keep information in, and some of them you'll find actually start the week with Monday being day number one. And there's some logic in that because, you know, most people start working on Monday. Of course, if Monday is day one, then Friday is day 5, Saturday is day 6, and the seventh day of the week is, lo and behold, Sunday. Oh, the Lord's Day. Well, that's handy. So therefore, it's quite possible for those who are not being alert and sharp to be persuaded that Sunday is the seventh day of the week. And, oh, well, that's fine. If we are to keep holy the seventh day of the week, I guess that must be Sunday, mustn't it? Now, I don't know whether that particular... Those calendars are very popular, I've got to say, in Europe, in the continent especially, whether that'll be part of Satan's game to finally deceive people by making them think they're keeping the seventh day. I don't know. It's certainly curious. And I don't know why, I woke up this morning thinking about the Sabbath day, and for some reason I'd got a book in my mind, which was given to me about 10, 12 years ago by some Seventh-day Adventists, and I found it out at lunchtime. It's about the Scots, the Scottish nation, the Celts, and I always like to try and find some of the good things that the Scottish have done over the centuries, showing their, you know, innate superiority to other tribes and nations. Of course, in looking for such good things, you generally have to crawl over lots of rather bad, evil things they've done. But now and then you find a little nugget where the Scots actually get something right for a change. And very interestingly, I said a few moments ago that I was educated at St. Margaret's Roman Catholic School. St. Margaret was a highly renowned saint in Scotland. She was also a queen of Scotland, going back to round about 1069-ish. So when the English were being taken over by the Norman conquest up in Scotland, we had a Queen Margaret. Now there's a copy of a letter I've got, an excerpt of at least, where Queen Margaret was writing to those in the south in England and complaining of some of the weird, strange customs of the Scottish nation. One of which, amazingly, was that in 1060-odd, the Scots as a nation actually kept the Saturday Sabbath. And she was writing to the English, her relatives in England, saying that this is amazing. I mean, these people actually work on Sundays and the rest of the week, and the Scots actually keep Saturday as their Sabbath day. And in fact, they'd done that for centuries since they were first visited by, you know, true Christians way back in the earlier years of the New Testament. So the Scots kept the Sabbath right up to round about 1000 AD, 1100 AD. But Queen Margaret, who is honoured and revered and is now a saint in the Catholic Church, was, I think, largely made a saint because she stamped out the Sabbath observance in Scotland and replaced it with Sunday worship, thus, of course, getting the Pope on her side, and so she was eventually made Saint Margaret. I think she wasn't. Carrying on, verse 12. Honour your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Eternal your God is giving you. You shall not murder. Or it says, you shall not kill, but it means basically murder. There are many death penalties imposed for certain crimes. We'll cover probably next time now. So killing, if it's properly done by the government, according to God's civil laws, is fine. But murder, obviously not. You shall not commit adultery. Tell that to the world today. There'll be, I think, a large number of TV programs. Hate to harbour on the same point again, which you couldn't actually show on TV if they didn't include adultery. If you said, look, no adultery to be shown on TV, I guess half the programs would be off the air. Verse 15, you shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbour, which is commandment number 9, but in the Catholic commandments is number 8. Okay? Verse 17, commandment number 10, you shall not covet your neighbour's house. You shall not covet your neighbour's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, his ox, his donkey, his Lexus, his Cadillac, nor anything else that is your neighbour's. That's commandment number 10. So what happens in the Catholic commandments? Well, they actually split that commandment into two, because they've got to end up with 10, don't forget. There are 10 commandments. They've dropped commandment 2 out of the equation. When they get to this one, they create two commandments. From memory, I think, one is, thou shalt not covet thy neighbour's wife. That's one commandment. And then the next commandment, anything else of your neighbour's. So there's two commandments not to covet, rather than the one that we find in our Bibles. There are still 10 Catholic commandments, but the numbering is a wee bit different. Continuing verse 18. Now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off, highly nervous. Then they said to Moses, I tell you what, Moses, you speak with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die. They really did not have any confidence in this God being. They had no trust in him. They were always expecting him to finally at last spring the trap on them and kill them. And as we said, I think last time we spoke together, they refused to go into the promised land, and they ultimately, all the adults, died in the wilderness, as they had always claimed God wanted to do. They got finally what they kept on talking about. Verse 20, and Moses said to the people, do not fear, for God has come to test you, and that his fear may be before you, so that you may not sin. So the people stood afar off, but Moses drew near the thick darkness where God was. And when you read something like God says, don't sin, it's not that God is trying to make people miserable. He's not saying, well, I know there's all these exciting things you'd love to do, like gambling and taking drugs, having a real high, that'd be good fun, wouldn't it? And of course, let's not forget chasing fast women, all the fun there and so on. But God's going to prevent that by having all these horrible commandments to make life really hard. You know, sin is destructive. It brings misery and unhappiness and ultimately death. The wages of sin is death. And God knows that, so he says, don't do those things that are harmful. Don't sin. Do the good things that bring you life. Verse 22, then the Eternal said to Moses, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, you have seen that I have talked with you from heaven. And, you know, that's what God had done. He had talked with them from heaven, you know, directly. You shall not make anything to be with me, gods of silver or gods of gold you shall not make for yourselves. An altar of earth you shall make for me, and you shall sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. There had always been sacrifices right from the Garden of Eden. Abraham gave sacrifices and offerings, and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph. Earlier I was talking about the sacrificial system, the complete priesthood. That was another year or so away. But there had always been the opportunity to be generous to God and give him, you know, an offering of some sort. And that continued. An altar of earth, not in every place where I record my name, I will come to you and I will bless you. And if you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stone. You know, don't shape it and so on. For if you use your tool on it, you have profaned it. Nor shall you go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness may not be exposed on it. I guess, I don't know for sure, but I imagine that the priests may have had something like a kilt. And I don't know what, that's always a big mystery what the Scots wear under their kilts, of course. And there's a lot of people always intrigued to find out what the answer is. But it looks like perhaps in those days, the priests under their kilts might not have had much at all. And had they climbed up some steps so high up, it might have been all rather embarrassing, which God did not want to take place. I think we'll just continue just for a few verses in chapter 21, another 5 minutes or so, and then we'll be released and perhaps relieved. But there's a lot to get through in this book, so I'll try and get another few verses into it. Chapter 21, verse 1. Now these are the judgments which you shall set before them. This is God talking now to Moses, and he says, look, Moses, you've been trying to sort out all these disputes among the people. There are contentions and arguments with each other, and they're going to continue from now on forever, really. So here are some regulations, some legal judgments which you can use. These will set out, Moses, for you certain principles of how to go about dealing with disputes. And the first, I guess, first 32 verses deals with the rights of individual persons. After that, it goes into property rights. And we have these same things today, whether it's Texas or Wisconsin or England or Scotland, there are always various legal ordinances that set out how we as a civilized people should live together. Ours don't work very well. The nation of Israel, had it done things God's way, would have worked far, far better. So verse 2, if you buy a Hebrew servant, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free and pay nothing. Now, for us, you know, buying a servant sounds pretty pretty odd. Isn't that slavery? You know, why would you have slavery in Israel? Shouldn't God ban that entirely? The answer is, well, perhaps. But God was dealing with a very carnal people. Very carnal people. And they were used to, you know, buying and selling individuals. And I guess God recognized their hard-heartedness, but was saying, okay, there's no question this will continue because of your hard hearts, but I will make sure that there are very fair regulations in place giving legal rights to these individuals, which must be respected. I mean, today, we may not have slavery exactly, but there are many, many people working in Britain, I can assure you, and I imagine the same across the USA, where people work for an absolute minute sum of money in almost slave-like conditions. There are people here in Britain every autumn, every fall, who are employed working in the fields for, you know, just a few dollars a day, and they work in terrible conditions all day long. Their health and safety is always, frankly, in jeopardy, and they're paid hardly anything. And many of them are actually illegal aliens in this country. If they're injured, they're just whisked back to their own countries, and if they lose an eye or a leg, they can't claim any compensation. They are treated like slaves. They have no rights. And yet, you know, it's not slavery exactly, but in many ways, there are people in our society today whose quality of life is, frankly, poorer than the slave people, the servants, the indentured servants of Moses' day. Because here, look, after 6 years, he's free. Not bad. Verse 3, if he comes in by himself, you know, volunteers, shall we say, to serve as an indentured servant, he shall go out by himself. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. So if he brings his wife in and they serve together as indentured servants, bond servants, then when he goes, she goes. You know, you can't hold her back. So he has a right to take his wife with him. Verse 4, if his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. Ooh, that doesn't sound as good in many ways, but, you know, the woman was the property of the master, and the children born in his household and fed in his household, in that sense, would belong to him. So when the man goes out, he would, in theory, have to consider leaving his wife behind. But verse 5, if the servant plainly says, well, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him to the judges. The Hebrew there is Elohim. You could translate that gods, but it properly would be translated, I think, as judges or magistrates. He shall also bring him to the door, or to the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him then, you know, for the rest of his life. And so, if the guy says, well, I quite like working here, it's quite a good life, the master is a very kind guy, he looks after me, he houses me and my wife and family, we're being well fed, the kids are being educated, frankly, I don't want to go anywhere else, this is pretty good for me, then he would offer to become indentured for life. And this particular ceremony of having your ear pierced against the doorpost sounds a bit painful to me, but that would be the ceremony which would indicate that condition. Verse 7, and if a man sells his daughter to be a maidservant, she shall not go out as the men servants do. I mean, ideally, of course, this should never happen. But this was a carnal, hard-hearted people. It was going to happen, but God was ensuring that legally all these people had got legal rights they could call upon. If she does not please her master, who has betrothed her to himself, so I guess sometimes there'd be a betrothal as part of this, perhaps not all the time, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has dealt deceitfully with her. So if he had, say, engaged to marry her, but then changed his mind, he had to allow her to go back to her parents upon redemption. He couldn't pass her on. She had got a legal right to return to her former life. Verse 9, and if he has betrothed her to his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. She has all the rights that the man's own daughters would have. Verse 10, if he, that would be the son, takes another wife, So the son perhaps doesn't eventually want to marry this girl, chooses a separate wife, or perhaps even a second wife. He shall not diminish her food, her clothing, and her marriage rights. And if he does not do these three for her, then she shall go out free without paying money. So she's free to go completely if she doesn't get these legal rights honored. We'll do one more, I think. Then we'll conclude for today. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. That's part of the administration of death. You know, if you kill somebody, murder, then you must pay the death penalty. Verse 13, but if he did not lie in wait, so it wasn't that sense premeditated, but God delivered him into his hand, I guess an act of God, so to speak, then I will appoint for you a place where he may flee. So it was accidental death, you know, not premeditated. Then there was a place where the culprit could race off for some safety. Verse 14, but if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him with guile, with treachery, you shall take him even from my altar that he may die. So if a guy plans to murder, sets it up, carries out the murder, and then races off to try and get a place of refuge, even if he's hanging onto God's altar, the police are allowed to go up and grab him and bring him away to kill him, to execute him, so that he has no protection. Like today, sometimes people will, in some countries, try and hide in a cathedral and try and say that they're taking asylum there. It wouldn't work in this situation. Verse 15, and he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Death penalty again. He who kidnaps a man and sells him, or if he is found in his hand, shall surely be put to death. So kidnapping, the penalty in God's system is not putting you in prison for 5 years or 10 years or life. In fact, as we look through these in the next week or two, we won't find any reference to going to prison. That's not God's system. You know, prisons do what? Well, you lock people in a little room of 8 feet by 10 feet, sometimes three or four or more men or women, I guess. Toilet facilities, pretty basic. And in prison, most people learn to be what? Better criminals. Homosexuality is rampant, disease. And most people, when they're allowed out of prison, most people quickly reoffend. They don't seem to achieve an awful lot, and of course they're hugely costly to maintain. You won't find, as I say, much reference in God's regulations here to imprisonment. What you do find, for example, with kidnapping and the murder and striking your father or mother, is basically the penalty of death is exacted. Okay, that'll take us up to verse, 17, and we can't obviously continue all of chapter 21 today. So I think on that basis, we'll conclude the Bible study for this morning. If I can then ask perhaps Henry, if you're still there, if you could just close with a prayer, then we will dismiss.